This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Universal Periodic Review NGO Working Group calls on the government of Botswana and other countries to distance themselves from this controversial UK program, which appears to be aimed at protecting only some of those who are fleeing their countries on the basis of fear of prosecution and not others.
That's Kutluano Rilonti, Program Manager for Botswana Coalition of the Universal Periodic Review NGO Working Group, asking the governments and other countries to distance themselves from the UK's asylum program. Details coming up. Also, a high-level Africa counter-terrorism summit in Nigeria warns that Africa is becoming the world's epicenter for terrorism. And the Kenyan government is threatening to withhold pay for striking doctors. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Botswana says it has rejected a proposal to accept asylum seekers from the UK, an arrangement similar to the one that Rwanda has agreed to. The UK's House of Lords on Monday passed a bill that will see migrants deported to Rwanda in a move condemned by human rights activists and the United Nations. From Habroni, Botswana, Mokendisi Dube reports.
An umbrella of civil society organizations in Botswana this week urged the government to reject proposals from the UK to send thousands of migrants to the African nation. Botswana's Minister for Foreign Affairs, Lemogang Kwape, told VOA that UK authorities had reached out, but Habron authorities would not commit to hosting people not knowing what the end game would be. Kutluano Rilonti is the program manager for the Botswana Coalition, the Universal Periodic Review, UPR NGO Working Group.
The Universal Periodic Review NGO Working Group calls on the government of Botswana and other countries to distance themselves from this controversial UK program, which appears to be aimed at protecting only some of those who are fleeing their countries on the basis of fear of prosecution and not others. We noted that in the case of the conflict in Ukraine, those seeking asylum were fast-tracked into the system and citizens even encouraged to host them in their homes.
Further, the group says the UK government should respect international conventions on the treatment of migrants.
We call upon the UK government to uphold international human rights principles and instruments in dealing with asylum seekers.
In enacting the law, the UK says it wants to put an end to the irregular arrival of asylum seekers from mostly Asia and Africa via small boats. Jonathan Portes, a professor of economics and public policy in the UK, says under the Rwanda arrangement, some deserving asylum seekers will be turned away.
There is a general view that the small boats crisis needs to be resolved, that it's very dangerous and unacceptable for people to be arriving in such numbers on boats across the channel, but that does not mean that the majority of the population wants to send people, particularly people in need who would have a claim to refugee status, to Rwanda.
Portes says it is not surprising that countries such as Botswana are turning down the controversial policy after it came under heavy criticism from the United Nations and activists.
And frankly, it would be highly unwise for any other country to participate in this, both from a reputational and practical point of view. I think, frankly, even the Rwandans, despite being offered really quite remarkably large sums of money by the UK government, are having, at the very least, second thoughts about whether this policy is sensible.
The policy was first initiated 2 years ago, but the UK Supreme Court ruled it unlawful, which halted deportation. Following Monday's passage of the bill, the UK is expected to start deporting asylum seekers to Rwanda by mid-July. Mkondisi Dube, VOA News, Habaroni, Botswana.
Unlike Botswana, the UK will pay at least $460 million to Rwanda as part of its plan to relocate asylum seekers there. The Rwanda bill will be open to anyone whose asylum claim has been rejected by the UK, and in particular, it is aimed at those who cannot return to their home countries. The bill is a victory for British Conservative Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Alex Vines, who leads the Africa program at Chatham House and is Managing Director for Risk, Ethics and Resilience, tells me, come November, the Labour Party, which opposes the Rwanda bill, could assume power.
The Rwanda bill will become law, but it could still be challenged in the court. Law firms are going to take up individual cases. The government here in the UK is talking about the first flight maybe leaving for Kigali in June, July. The British government believes that it can ignore the European human rights and send people.
Rwanda is saying money is being injected into the country and the UK has already provided the first installment, which in return will support economic growth. So this is all about money for Rwanda, because there are a lot of human rights issues that have come up regarding Rwanda.
So you're absolutely right that the UK government has paid about £140 million to the Rwandan government. And it is, the bill is actually not just a bill around migration, but it is a development bill. So the Rwandan government has received significant revenue for this. Rwanda is a landlocked country. It is a developing country. It has an ambition to be middle income. And its international partnership with the United Kingdom is an important one as part of a number of relationships that Kigali has been developing over recent years. So money is clearly an important part of the incentive for the government of Paul Kagame. But the UK also provides some diplomatic cover and partnership for Rwanda. You may have noticed that whereas the United States, the UN, and the EU have criticized Rwanda for its support of M23 rebels in eastern Congo, that isn't something that you hear publicly from the UK government, for example.
For the migrants at the transit center and for those still to come, this is all about seeking a better future. Will Rwanda be a detour for them or a dead end or a new home?
If you've been to Rwanda, the economic growth there and opportunities do exist. Kigali is a safe city. And if you stay out of local politics, you can thrive. But Kigali is not a global multicultural city. So one does wonder how Syrians or Afghanis might be integrated into broader Rwandan society long term if they become Rwandan citizens. That is something that we have no idea at the moment.
And is this a victory for the Prime Minister?
Yes, one of the big undertakings of British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been to stop the boats. He's used that slogan. And so we'll see. But to be honest with you, this will only be determined longer term, whether this will act as a deterrent. A couple of flights with a few people on board to Kigali is not, I think, going to be a deterrent. This is about a longer call question. And we may not see this because the party of opposition, the leading party of opposition, the Labour Party, says that they would stop this and would create a different system. And we know that there are going to be elections in the United Kingdom this year. My own guess is it will probably be November. And all the opinion polls at the moment show that the Conservative Party, the party of government, will handsomely lose. So we're likely to see change of government here and change of party by the end of the year.
Are you saying, and that could reverse this whole immigration bill?
This is an issue that whoever's in government will have to deal with. I think the question is whether putting up people on planes to Rwanda in this manner is the best way forward, or whether there's another model of encouraging people to locations for processing and applying for asylum outside the United Kingdom might be an alternative. And I think that is what the Labour Party is looking at the moment.
That was Alex Vines, who leads the Africa program at Chatham House. He talked to me from London. A high-level Africa counter-terrorism summit opened in Nigeria Monday with hundreds of delegates from around the world. Africa has become the world's epicenter of terrorism. Leaders at the summit hope to change that through regional cooperation and partnerships. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Hundreds of delegates from across the world stand as a military band plays the Nigerian national anthem at the opening of a two-day Africa Counterterrorism Summit in Abuja. The summit was jointly hosted by Nigeria and the United Nations Office of Counterterrorism, UNOCT, with the aim of strengthening regional security response and cooperation against acts of terror. Nigerian President Bola Tinubu spoke at the summit.
Terrorism snaps at the very fabric of the prosperous and just society we seek to build for ourselves and our children. This violent threat seeks to frighten the farmer from his fields, children from their schools, women from the marketplace, and families from their very homes. We must therefore fight this threat together, combining determined national efforts with well-tailored regional and international collaboration.
The summit seeks to enhance intelligence sharing among African nations and promote African-led strategies on counterterrorism. Authorities say it will also serve as a guide to the international community's collective response to terrorism in Africa. Terrorism and violent extremism are spreading at an alarming rate in Africa, according to a new study by the African Center for Strategic Studies. Acts of terror increased by more than 100,000% in the last two decades, despite local and foreign intervention. The report says more than 23,000 people were killed in Africa last year, a 20% increase compared to 2022. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo says fighting terrorism goes beyond a country's borders.
The evolving nature of terrorism demands a dynamic and coordinated response that transcends national borders and individual efforts. These groups are exploiting grievances and vulnerabilities and are manipulating ideologies to spread fear, division, and chaos. We recognize the urgent need for concerted efforts to combat this great menace that continues to threaten the peace, security, and development of our continent.
Authorities say the threat of terrorism in Africa is exacerbated by the illicit arms trade, unemployment, poverty, inadequate policing, marginalization, and political instability. For more than a decade, Nigeria has struggled to stem the violence by Boko Haram and its splinter, ISWAP, in the northeast. And more recently, armed gangs known as bandits have been making matters worse. Authorities hope to change the narrative for the better. Vladimir Voronkov is the Undersecretary General of the UNOCT.
To effectively counter terrorism, African regional organizations have an important role to play. The success of the United Nations in Africa hinges on our commitment to support African-led solutions to African challenges. We recognize no single actor can resolve today's threats to peace and security. Instead, we need multiple actors working together with solutions grounded in strong national ownership.
Acts of terror in Africa are largely concentrated in the Sahel, Somalia, the Lake Chad Basin, North Africa, and Mozambique. Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso were absent from the summit due to coup-related sanctions imposed by ECOWAS and the African Union. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Reporters Without Borders ranked Tunisia as the 121st out of 180 countries in its Freedom of the Press Index for 2023. The constitutional amendment of July 2022 giving President Kais Saied broad legislative powers to the detriment of the existing checks and balances has jeopardized the separation of powers and poses a major threat to the Tunisian revolution's achievements in terms of press freedom. Sarah Kamis, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Maryland, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi the many restrictions that Saied has imposed on political reporting.
Tunisia, of course, as we all know, is the birthplace of the Arab Spring. It's the cradle of the Arab Spring uprisings. However, it is sad enough that starting from 2021, we have started to see a backlash in terms of democratic and reform efforts in Tunisia. The socio-political transformation that has been described before as a role model and an exemplary model for other countries to follow in terms of being peaceful and bloodless and smooth has been jeopardized by President Kais Saied's measures, the presidential decree, which seized a lot of powers and really kind of consolidated a lot of authorities and powers in his hands, and a very slim margin of freedom and opposition in the political sphere in general, which also had negative and dire implications on the media sphere in particular. I always say that media and politics cannot be separated from one another. So whatever happens in the political sphere will always inevitably impact the media sphere for sure. And therefore, it's very sad to see that now there are punitive measures, there are now cybercrime laws and other types of laws that are being used in order to crack down on journalism and journalists and press freedom in Tunisia. We have seen the closing down of different media institutions like Al Zaytuna TV, for example, Al Arabi TV headquarters, Al Jazeera headquarters, arresting some journalists like Samir Sassi, the journalist working for Al Jazeera. He was detained for a few days and released later on. Most recently, Mohamed Bouhalib, a Tunisian journalist, has been arrested under charges of defamation. And these charges of defamation, or basically spreading misinformation or disinformation, have been used in order to crack down on journalism and journalists in Tunisia, unfortunately.
Media analysts say that the media landscape in Tunisia has grown more diverse since the 2011 revolution, but political crisis that engulfed the country after the power grab of Kais Saied and his uncertain commitment to press freedom has undermined the independence of many media outlets. Can you explain what happened to media independence in Tunisia?
Tunisia, again, you know, being this kind of quote-unquote the Tunisian exceptionalism model. Now, with the crackdown on the political life and press freedom in Tunisia, what is happening now is a detour. It's a backlash. So we are seeing now, for example, the closing down of several media organizations, blocking and shutting down different websites and cracking down on journalists and the arrests and detentions of different journalists under different charges, from defamation to spreading misinformation to spreading disinformation. All of these have been used as excuses in order to crack down on journalism in Tunisia and to also try to have an iron fist policy which controls the media landscape from the government itself and by the authorities in power without leaving a lot of room for diversity and plurality. And that is really heartbreaking when you think about where Tunisia was just a few years ago and where it's now in terms of political and media freedom.
The escalation of violations against Tunisian journalists led the National Syndicate of Tunisian Journalists to take steps to push back against restrictive measures taken by President Kais Saied. How effective were these types of resistance?
I think it's very important to remember that this kind of crackdown is not without resistance. Tunisian journalists, to their credit, against all odds, are trying very hard to push back against this kind of crackdown and this kind of, you know, strict imposition of certain laws and regulations and using cybercrime laws and other punitive measures against journalists and really not allowing them to or play the role that they're supposed to be playing in terms of spreading the truth and speaking truth to power. It took different forms through the journalist syndicate and through the individual journalists themselves. Many of them started to submit petitions to organize protests and demonstrations and sit-ins. It is not clear now how effective these measures are going to be on the long run, but at least on the short run, we can say with confidence that they are really pushing back and resisting these types of backlashes and these types of detours in both political and media freedoms, and we should really give them a lot of credit for doing so.
That was Sarah Khamis, Associate Professor of Communication at the University of Maryland, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi. Artificial intelligence surrounds U.S. political life, from fundraising to campaign advertising. Some lawmakers are looking to better police the use of generative content in this year's U.S. presidential election, as they say it threatens voter confidence in what is real. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
So far, artificial intelligence in this presidential campaign has been most pronounced in the New Hampshire primary, where thousands of voters received a call from a voice sounding like Joe Biden telling them not to vote.
Voting this Tuesday only enables the Republicans in their quest to elect Donald Trump again.
The fake voice was made by Louisiana magician Paul Carpenter for $150.
If anybody's looking for some kind of flag, not a false flag, but like a flag, a gameplay flag where something bad happened, and I'm the flag.
U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal says there's no time to wait for another flag.
Disinformation and deepfakes are about to descend on the American public. The form of their arrival will be political ads and other forms of disinformation that are made possible by artificial intelligence. There is a clear and present danger to our democracy.
At a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on AI in this election last week, Senator Josh Hawley said it's time to act.
The dangers of this technology without guardrails and without safety features are becoming painfully, painfully apparent. And I think the question now is that are we going to have to watch some catastrophe unfold?
It's already possible to detect calls like the one in New Hampshire, says artificial voice generation developer Zohaib Ahmed.
We believe that AI watermarking technology is a readily available solution that can already check the integrity of audio content.
With that technology in place, what's lacking is regulation, says deepfake detection entrepreneur Ben Coleman.
There's a really nice framework in both national and also state-level regulations in the space. When you upload something on, for example, YouTube, it's checking for a few things. It's checking for violence. It's checking for underage imagery. It's checking for, are you uploading the latest Drake song? That's because of regulations. So to scan for generative media would just be another check within that same flow.
The U.S. Federal Election Commission is considering rules that would prohibit using AI in ads to deliberately deceive voters. New Hampshire Secretary of State David Scanlon told the Senate committee that unchecked generative AI, like the fake Biden call, threatens voter confidence.
The most fundamental, important thing that I perceive in my role as Secretary of State is to make sure that an election is not messed up, that, you know, the voters believe and know that it was run fairly and accurately to the highest standards possible. And if we lose that, it will be very, very hard to get it back.
In New Hampshire, lawmakers are working to require that political advertising within 90 days of an election disclose if audio, still images, or video have, quote, been manipulated or generated by artificial intelligence technology and depicts speech or conduct that did not occur. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Rainstorms and flash floods wreaked havoc across the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, today. The UN Humanitarian Response Agency, OCHA, says at least 32 people have died and more than 40,000 were forced from their homes. Many parts of the country and the East African region have been lashed by relentless rains in recent weeks as the El Nino weather pattern exacerbates the seasonal rainfall. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.